Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue here this morning, and joining me is none other than one of our favorite world travelers, Grant Newsham. Grant, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
All right. First of all, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, so I can't screw around too much. But are you following the Washington Nationals? Are you pleased with the way they started? Give us an update on your baseball prognostication.
Well, I haven't followed them too closely since I'm watching the trade wars too much. But I think they've stood that time. Yeah, I think they're doing okay. But they could be like 20-0 right now. But since you're a Senators fan, you used to be, you'd probably expect them to go 0-20. so however well they're doing, that's, let's see. So far, so good.
All right, so somewhere in between is good.
Mm-hmm. If you're winning 20% of the time, you're doing okay.
All right, first of all, let's start. The biggest news last week is the falling apart of a trade deal that was never very firm to begin with. The news was back and forth based on what you could, tell, if you could tell anything that comes out of the news. You've taught us a lot about this kind of stuff and what it's going to take for the United States, as it begins, the process of standing up on its hind legs relative to trade and a host of other issues in the Western Pacific, that it historically hasn't done that. This is just another chapter as the Chinese try to, I would think, leverage the looming election that's gonna, that happens here in the United States in a couple years, against Mr. Trump's need for the economy to go well, to get reelected, and to try to get him to drop, some of his demands, on the Chinese, which I think we all know are pretty reasonable. What do you make of the most recent, dance?
It's pretty interesting. It's the first time I've ever seen anything like this. If you look back at, for say, the 20 years or so since China got into the World Trade Organization, you have never heard an American president say, we're getting cheated, this has to stop, and no deal. You simply have never heard that. I would say go back to the Bill Clinton's era. Which actually is a better start date, say the early 90s, and you simply never heard that. So, this was historic, if anybody noticed it. Of course, it's only been about, say, a day and a half that we've been standing firm on this one. So by Monday, who knows? But it is a big deal. The Chinese simply did their usual, which is let you think you've got a deal, and then at the very end, spring something else that really rewrites the whole thing in their favor. And usually the Westerners are so desperate to reach an agreement that they sort of even grudgingly they back down. Trump, I think he knew what was coming. He's got good advisors. And as a result, they were ready and just told the Chinese no. And this is that alone, you sort of enjoy that while you can. We have to see how this plays out, but what we have now is a no trade deal, and the tariffs have gone up from 10 to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese products. And that's about the best we could hope for at the moment, to my way of thinking. So we'll see how this goes. There's obviously going to be constituencies in the United States that are screaming about this. There have been already. But I think the Americans have the better hand to play, and China, the Chinese are the ones who are sweating now. and it's going to be very hard for them to back down on this. So hopefully the Trump administration will resist the urge to give them a break on this. But it's going to get interesting. We'll see how it plays out unless, say, Monday the Americans have caved in. And, you know, one never quite knows, but I'm hoping we don't and we stick with it for a while.
Well, you know, it was interesting. You see the host of stories about the, pork producers that are going to be hurt and whether it be the soybean farmers that are going to be hurt. But in the meantime, you know, when you look at the economy and the economic damage that gets done by what the Chinese do all over the world, honestly, it's confounding why the major industrial nations, the major free democratic nations don't stand together and just don't say, hey, we need to sit down and have a conversation about this, because you know every one of them is watching the United States, Grant, and watching, you know, are they really going to stick to their guns on intellectual property? Are they really going to stick to their guns on the forced transfer of technology? Because, I mean, those are big issues, global trade issues, and will the United States stick to it? And so it's certainly a fight that needs to happen, and, you know, China needs to grow up and become one of the modern industrial nations, but I guess what incentive is there if everybody will roll over? So it's been interesting as all those stories kind of pour out and people, you know, this is, you see the, you know, I think the headline in the Washington Post was, you know, Trump levies a 25% on tax that is a tariff on Chinese goods, which is really a tax on the American people. And so I don't, you see all these very narrow views of what happened and not so much written about this is where we need to go as a nation economically. So it'll be any interesting. If you looked into your crystal ball, what do you see?
I see this continuing for a while. I say Mr. Trump has got some advisors around him who understand that this is necessary if we are going to sort of disentangle ourselves from China, which is an enemy of the United States, and it's made it very clear it wants to not just displace us, but to dominate us. And tariffs, the tariffs are best seen not as a way to make the trade imbalance disappear, but as a way to, it's kind of a blunt weapon, to apply such pressure on, economic pressure, financial pressure on the Chinese regime, that they have to make some very tough decisions about how they are going to behave. And you pointed out about a lot of the press coverage, particularly from the Washington Post, it's claiming that, well, these tariffs are hurting the American people, hurting poor people, and it's Mr. Trump's fault. There's no mention of what the Chinese have done to bring them to this, really to this stage that's provoked us in this way, and the damage which has already been done to so much of sort of the American, sort of the manufacturing class in particular. And so that is the way, it's this self-censorship or this insane anti-Trump thinking that does shape a lot of the coverage here. In terms of tariffs being a tax on poor people, I don't think that really stands up to examination, but nobody takes the time to actually do that. But what it is creating a disincentive or an incentive not to do business with sort of hyper-nationalist, hyper-expansionist, fascist, totalitarian regime, ultimately, that is looking toward us. And specifically, one thing to consider is that if you put these tariffs on, that this is costing the Chinese Communist Party. That's who's paying for it. This is a few $100 billion that they suddenly don't have. And this is convertible currency to keep in mind. So the money that they have to pay on these tariffs is U.S. dollars. And they've only got so much of that, both in reserve or in their income. And this is giving them a case of the shorts, which is a good thing. And that's to say it's never mentioned, never written about. But one should consider the difficult situation the Chinese government is in as a result of these tariffs. So I think that the Trump administration is going to stick with it. I expect the the Chinese to start singing a different tune pretty soon, so with the usual, oh, we didn't really mean it, we can work out a win-win sort of thing. And then I would expect them to make a number of promises, maybe even change their laws a little bit. But whatever promises they break, whatever laws they change, it won't make any difference. They will cheat constantly, and they will have to put in all sorts of effort to try and catch them. And also, if so, I'm pretty skeptical about an agreement being reached, though I think at some point there will be some sort of mutual, if not understanding, at least a ceasefire.
Well, Grant, how that, but let me ask you this. And so if I was somebody, if I do this with the United States, you know what that means. I mean, there will be the domino theory of Chinese, economics. I mean, I'm going to put myself out of business or substantially alter the way I do business if there is no more forced technology transfer, if I agree to that, and if I level the playing field relative to tariffs. That's not how I do business. I have this huge market. I'll let you sell into it, but in terms of level playing field, that's not what we do. And so it's really, I used to, when Jimmy Carter would go around the world talking about human rights, when you talk about human rights to a communist country, you're talking about the end of the way they do business. And so how does, from the Chinese perspective, how do they do it? I mean, being brought to heel by by the United States means we're going to get brought to heel by other nations shortly thereafter. Be Chinese for a second, and how do we navigate this?
I would make some promises to the United States, and with no intention of keeping them, and I would violate them in a way that it's a lot of effort to detect and then a lot of effort to do something about. And then I would play hardball with other countries. If the other countries are not going to band together with the United States, and that's the one thing that would really scare the Chinese, then they can take on these other countries one-on-one. And that would be my approach, is placate the Americans, and they really play rough with the others. With the Canadians cut off their canola oil imports, the Australians, suddenly the coal shipments are not being allowed into port, the Philippines cut off, leave the bananas on the dock. That would be the best bet, is to try and make it seem like you've turned over a new leaf, and then and hope the Americans cannot cobble together a sort of an alliance, and then wait for their secret weapon, the JB-20, to be developed, which is the Joseph Biden 2020.
God Almighty, again, now that I'm smarter about this, the stuff he said, I don't think the Chinese are really our enemy, and it's all the stuff that Barack Obama went around the world, and we can get along with them, and this this whole confrontation is made by him, and you hear that and just like, God, here we go back on our our hands and knees again relative to the Chinese.
I'm not really joking, unfortunately.
Right.
Because it doesn't necessarily have to be Joseph Biden, but there is in the American sort of elite class, both officialdom, academia in particular, in business, you've got people who were just, I think, are sort of out in the wilderness, not the wilderness, it's a very plush wilderness there, sort of gritting their teeth, waiting for a chance to come back. I've heard one bright guy refer to it, they're waiting for the restoration. And these are the people whose accommodationist ideas created this Frankenstein, and they still don't seem to understand that they were wrong, and to recognize the danger they put the country in. But they are, they're waiting for their chance to come back, and it's easy to forget just how sort of recent and how really short this current administration, and it's a forceful and or just principled, backboned approach to China has is, and it's really sort of trying to change 40 years of history. But these people are still out there; they're still waiting. And if a new administration comes in, I wouldn't be surprised to see our China policy go back to something akin to what it was. And if you think you can make a deal with the Chinese on trade or almost anything else, but just talking about trade, right. But like you said, this would require them to change their business model. And if they did, that would also require the Chinese Communist Party to give up some control over China, over its citizens, and to allow more freedom, to allow, say, a contract to be decided without the Chinese Communist Party having ultimate control, having independent judges. This would be, it's just something they really can't abide. But if you have an administration that's willing to just sort of see their point of view and, you know, make some concessions and go back to the way things were, and a lot of Wall Street is pushing for this, that if you have that, then the status quo will be back, and we will, probably lose. I think you would expect ultimate Chinese global domination in that case. So if I was the Chinese, that's what I would do, is placate the Americans, make it look like you change, but don't, and then keep a united sort of front from forming against you, and then wait for some time to pass, wait for the Americans to get tired, and for some more friendly people to come into an American administration, and then I think they'd be back to where they want to be.
Got it. Now, when you look at it from their perspective, I mean, this is not something that's good. You know, somebody's digging their heels in, and, you know, I'm sure it's an interesting plane ride home, because where's the wiggle room? Where's the place where we make a deal without capitulating to the Americans? And if we do, what are the implications for our business model? So I think it's very interesting. In the South China Sea, the Philippines, the United States, Vietnam, was it France? There was about four countries that got together in the South China Sea, which is, as far as I can remember in the last couple of years, the largest number of nations to do that. What's going on there? Last time I got excited about Vietnam pushing back on China, you told me to cool my jets. So,
I shouldn't have said that. It's, they beat us, for crying out loud. You know, it's probably a little, there's a limit, said that, I apologize for that. But what just happened, is that you had, it looked like a four ship sort of convoy or squadron, flotilla, whatever you would call that,
right,
of a Japanese, the Izumo, which is their new quasi-aircraft carrier, with a U.S. ship, a Philippine ship, and an Indian Navy ship as well. And they had got a nice photo op with that sailing through the South China Sea. And that is significant. You know, it's, once again, it's not the end of the day, but, you know, say in baseball terms, it'd be like, smacking a really strong double, you know, through the gap in center or left center, rolls to the warning track. It's really nice, but it's not the end of the game.
Right.
But it does. It's, you know, to get the Indians involved in this with the Japanese, with the Americans, and to get the Philippines to join in. It doesn't just happen by magic.
But right.
When it does represent some pretty good thinking on our side. The people that brought it about, and also a willingness on all the other sides to do something which China was not going to like. And given the sort of the standoffishness the Indians have had for always had, where they don't want to be seen doing too much with anyone, that this was good to see them there. The Japanese as well sent down their big ship here down to the South China Sea. And one should remember that when you read the stories about Mr. Abe trying to improve relations with China by sending a big business delegation over there when he went over for a visit. just recently, that it shows that, they did that, but at the same time, they sent their biggest ship down to the South China Sea and to try it, send a message, but make a demonstration of that they just might defend themselves. And then the Philippines, with Duterte, the President Duterte of the Philippines, having been, pro-China since he got in and before, and on the Chinese payroll to varying degrees, it shows that the Philippines is like any country. It's there's different factions, different opinions, and there's some who are very pro-American, anti-China, pro-American, opposed to what China is doing to the Philippines. And the fact they were able to get a ship out there, once again, it shows that we have a lot to work with if we make the effort. So this was very nice. Now it's important to look at what comes next. What are the things we do next and do after this? But, for the moment, that was a nice thing to see. And it's also worth noting that a lot of this is being done without advance notice. They're just going out and doing it, and they're not hiding it, and they do publicize it, but they're not telegraphing telegraphing punches and sort of tacitly requesting approval to go do it. So this is not something China would like to see, but they still do have a very strong hand in the South China Sea, both with these permanent bases on the man-made islands and just having a whole lot of ships down there constantly. This is very different than a few years ago in the last administration, or even the one before that, where China had a free hand down there and nobody was doing much, so we could de-escalate in hopes of getting Obamacare and the National Dental Plan in place and not being distracted by anything pesky that difficult that the Chinese might do. So that was a good thing to see, but there's still obviously a long way to go. But if we can keep this up, there's always something to be said for stirring and at least starting to defend yourself.
So it's trending at least in the right way that we're seeing more of these multinational efforts to sail through, and just as important, I think, as the military. Posturing and the statement sending that it says is the cooperation piece. It's going to have to happen economically, ultimately, to level the playing field. And the Indians know it. The United States knows it. And so I think these are all good indicators. And I agree with you. And certainly, not the end of the game. Or not even anywhere near it, but they're good indications that the free nations of the world are doing the right thing, and then kind of the little guys are hopping in with us, and I think those are good things. I want to ask you about the Chinese militia and the Philippine militia and the Vietnamese militia in terms of the navies. There's some very, very interesting articles being written about that ongoing confrontation. Can you explain what is going on down there? Are they ramming each other's ships and sinking them? What the hell is going on down there?
They are ramming ships, but it's not each other's. That's the problem. It's the Chinese ramming other ships. And what you're talking about is the thing called maritime militia. And this is effectively a sort of Chinese government officially sanctioned, funded, organized weaponization of their fishing fleet to include specially built fishing ships designed for ramming, sort of strength, particularly with the strengthened hulls, etc. They're armed. You might consider the crew members paramilitary. Fishermen or soldiers, are under direction of the Chinese government. And when they feel like it or when they're ordered, they actually will go after, say, Vietnamese or Philippine fishing boats that are in waters that China wants to control or dominate. claiming that it's Chinese, of course. And there's been a number of instances going back a while now of Chinese ships, fishing ships, ramming the Vietnamese ships and the fatalities involved. The Filipinos are thoroughly intimidated and really won't, are just scared to go out. To the extent they do go out, they avoid large stretches of the ocean, which are clearly Philippine waters. So it's really using your civilian fishing fleet as an adjunct to your military force. That would be like if you took those sport fishermen, say, that go out of San Pedro and, say, go out to Santa Catalina and giving them these sort of hyped-up, sort of these strong boats and paying for their fuel and telling them, you know, when you see a Mexican ship out there, ram it. You know, or keep them, you know, when we tell you, we want you to go after them, circle them, harass them, throw things at them, maybe even shoot at them, and if necessary, ram them and sink them. And we'll have the U.S. Coast Guard right behind you, and the Navy will be over the horizon. But then you can say, well, it's just fishermen arguing with each other. So it's used as an adjunct of the Chinese military. And the Chinese are the ones who really have this in large numbers. The Vietnamese haven't matched them at all, and the Philippines have not either. So when we talk about maritime militia, this really is something only the Chinese have. And the big thing about this is it's been a problem for at least a decade. There's a fellow named Andrew Erickson. He's at the Naval War College in Newport, who's been the one who's really brought all this to light and exposed it and reported on it really very well. Andrew Erickson, and if anyone's interested, his stuff is he's the gospel on it. But lately what happened is, I think it was the chief of naval operations actually told the Chinese that, hey, from now on, we're going to treat the maritime militia just like we do your Navy. And if you do something that threatens us, we're going to sort of use the kind of the rules of engagement we would use as if the Chinese Navy was doing it. And it was finally the U.S. side has said that. You know, it should have been said years ago. But once again, it was this real estate developer from Queens who was under his administration that America finally said what should have been said a long time ago. It remains to be seen how this will change the maritime militia's behavior, but it will certainly improve it towards the Americans, I should think. And they have harassed American ships, naval ships, in the past, so this is a good thing, and nice to see it happen. And it's referred to as addressing these gray zone provocations. You know, this, once again, you start here, and then if you actually keep at it, it does have the potential for changing perceptions and changing behaviors in the South China Sea and the East China Sea as well.
Well, you know, it is to me a big deal, because it seems to be the Chinese version of the little green men that we saw in the Crimea and that we see in the eastern Ukraine.
And we've
all seen how effective they have been in creating, an artificial event to which a nation responds. And so, in many ways, the little green men and the militia, the militia navy, are extremely powerful tools. Because if the bet is, well, they're not really going to come and go to war with us, then, you know, how do we influence policy? Well, we can influence policy by these uniformless actors that will go in and do our bidding, and then they'll scream when anybody pushes back. We'll scream, "Our citizens are being exploited. We're going there to protect them, and nobody's going to do anything about it." So to me, it's a big deal. And it was very interesting when the chief of naval operations said that, Admiral Richardson said that, hey, we will treat them exactly the same. So, interesting stuff. Grant, what about North Korea now? On our way to North Korea, and then we'll talk about Taiwan here in a second. What about is this just another one of those the dance steps that we do with North Korea? But one of the things I saw that we did that you said that until we begin to do this, the embargo won't be taken seriously, and that is, I believe, the Coast Guard. The Justice Department announced that the Coast Guard had had commandeered, confiscated, and a North Korean coal tanker that was transferring coal at sea. Talk to us about that, and is that another good trend line?
I think it is. As I understand it, the Americans got a hold of a sort of North Korean, as you said, a ship that has been transporting coal to North Korea, and also transporting other stuff as well. And my sense is that they grabbed it down in Indonesia, where the Indonesians had already grabbed it. Now, I could be wrong. Uh-huh. The reporting's been a little unclear, but it's nice to have the Indonesians cooperating. And then I gather it's being sent over to American Samoa, which is American territorial waters. But yes, this is a good thing to see, to actually to take a ship. You know, that we've never done it, and it'd be nice if we would take one of the ships that are breaking the sanctions up closer to North Korea in the East China Sea, for example. That the Japanese in particular spot them all the time, but they never actually do something to them when they spot them. And that would be even better if we could go into action up there. But you take what you can get, and this isn't bad. It does hold open the prospects of stronger future interventions, but they. Maybe it's one step back towards the earlier approach we had towards North Korea, really pressuring them economically and physically, etc. So we'll see where this goes. But it is hard to see a sort of a resolution of the North Korea problem. Just based on what you hear, what you read. Is it doesn't look like the North Koreans are going to sort of make the necessary concessions or do what they need to do, despite apparently having a terrible harvest this year and half the country starving, that there'll be a lot of pressure on the Americans to provide and allow food aid to go in, we've seen that play out before, but I would be inclined to not assist in this case, but it doesn't seem to say like there's going to be a resolution anytime soon. One thing that I find particularly useful to watch is South Korea and their domestic politics. The President Moon, who has been the one who's behind this sort of love fest with the North Koreans, thinking he could talk sense into them, he's getting less and less popular. And particularly the South Korean economy has been in bad shape for a long time, but it's just getting in worse and worse shape. And as time goes on, I think his popularity will go down even further. And their economy is going to get worse as well. And not too many people are going to be that interested in sort of sending presents to North Korea or even the issue period. They're more interested in their jobs. So that's the thing what I'm actually particularly focusing on, and I'm interested to see how he is going to respond to the Americans, because he's trying to play a double game with us, just keep us on the hook and sort of forced to support what he's trying to do with the North. I'm not sure how his domestic difficulties will play out towards us, but we'll see how that goes.
What's the next move? We've done this dance. Now we're back to shooting missiles, evidently missiles that have come from Russia. He went to Moscow, I think, and met with Vladimir Putin. So is this all more gamesmanship as North Korea? So what's the American next move is to, you know, begin to restage the exercises. You know, the Navy launched a missile after they launched a missile. Do we play tit for tat? Again, look into your crystal ball. What do you see?
I wouldn't be surprised if, maybe in, say, a month or two, that there's an announcement there's going to be another summit between Kim and Mr. Trump. I'm sure that the people on our side are working towards that and sort of trying to gauge the response from the North Koreans. I wouldn't be surprised if that was in the offing or something we might see in the future. You know, they've shot a missile. We've grabbed a boat. I grabbed one of their ships. And now, sir, I think the North Koreans might actually look as though they might feel like talking, is my sense. And even if there is a summit, I'm not optimistic about that. I think if we could somehow replay probably one of these talks from a year or two ago, we'd probably be about where we were then. I think we're kind of coming back to sort of the situation that was, where we're going to lean on them as much as we can.
Yeah, I don't. But again, like the Chinese, I mean, you know, what do you think Vladimir Putin told them? Hey, whatever you do, don't give up your nukes. That's your ace in the hole. Whatever you do, you know, dance, whatever dance you want to do, dance with the Americans, but do not give up your weapons. String them along sideways. There'll be another administration. It's, you know, the same playbook out of the Chinese and the Iranians. There'll be another administration that comes along pretty soon. You know, don't give in to them. You know, they never stick to these things. They will capitulate. I see this all as a masquerade until there's actual pain that threatens somebody. And I don't see that happening with the Chinese until, you know, you get, you know, multiple nations, you know, looking at the Chinese saying the same things. And they have to be multiple big economy nations that say the same things, with a whole bunch of little nations standing behind them saying, yeah, you know, we're kind of tired of this stuff too. With the North Koreans, I see the same thing. Is you know, we can talk about returning remains and all this other nice stuff, but, you know, the ball hasn't moved at all. Right?
I must agree. It's hard to imagine Kim sitting down with Putin and Putin saying, you know, this sort of antisocial behavior isn't getting you anywhere. What you got to do is let's do what the Americans want. You just can't conceive of that being said. And you say, why would he? For one thing. So I suspect it was more of a we got your back sort of sort of discussion.
Right. You know, you are one of the efforts in this multi-effort, fight against American domination of the world. And they think it's their world, and you know, the Iranians have a piece of it, you have a piece of it, we have a piece of it, the Chinese have a piece of it, and we need to keep them in their lane because they don't believe that you should, you know, be a strong nation. And we all, you know, I can hear it. So what, you know, I agree with you. Keep up the great work. You're doing great. Look where you've got your country. You didn't get, you would have never got there had you given these things up, and you won't get there. So I don't see that. Let's talk about first of all, before you go to Taiwan, is there anything interesting going on in Japan? You're a Japan watcher. Anything interesting? You talked about Mr. Abe's visit to China, which he does sail the big ship, but he also takes a big business delegation there. So which is exactly the way the Chinese are okay with it. Talk to me about anything new in Japan that we ought to talk about.
Well, one thing that's interesting, and it's a little bit specialized, is it's been announced that the Japanese are going to start assigning, or what you call it, deploying Japanese Marines, or the Ground Self-Defense Force, the Marines, onto Japanese amphibious ships, onto the LSTs class. And it looks like they're going to do it on a regular basis, not just on an ad hoc basis when there's some exercise that comes along, but actually to they do it all the time. And that's it's a nice development. It was thought impossible in 2012. And the numbers you've seen written are about a few hundred or so. I suspect it'll be less than that. But that is a positive development. It's like a lot of things, though, Japanese-y. It's sort of two steps forward, one and three quarter steps back. After it was announced, you'd see statements from Ministry of Defense bureaucrats saying, "Well, we're not going to sail them down towards our islands, however, because the Chinese might not like that." So whenever Japan does something sort of positive, there's a sort of instinctive or intentional reaction on the part of, say, the bureaucracy to defang it or make it as least effective as possible.
Right.
That's not concerned of, but nonetheless, it's a positive thing.
Right.
And I was saying, a year ago, when they did send one of their amphibious ships through the South China Sea and over to Vietnam, I wrote somewhere, "Well, next time, don't forget to bring the Marines with you." And they at some point they'd catch on. So what they needed to do. So this is something good. If you want to get better, as an amphibious force, this is what you have to do, and both particularly for the new amphibious rapid deployment brigade, but also for the Navy, the Japanese Navy, to sort of get used to dealing with the Army is an important thing. So it's a good step. Once again, it's not as much as one would like or as fast, but once compared to not too long ago when it was thought impossible, that this is some improvement.
All right. Talk to us about you've written a couple different times now about Taiwan, and Taiwan seems to be the kid that doesn't get to play anymore, right? And China has made it one of its national aims to at some point retake Taiwan, that they consider their own. The Taiwanese people aren't really fans of that, but you made an interesting comment when you said, it's not looked at as very prestigious to be in the Taiwanese military, and so you've written a couple times. Talk about us about the about your latest effort.
I've written a couple things actually, and sort of saying the same thing in different words, pointing out that the big problem afflicting the Taiwan military is not the lack of equipment or hardware, say not having F-35s, not having submarines, etc., but rather not being allowed to practice with anybody, not being allowed to trade with us or train with us. So the Taiwan military is this Galapagos military, where it's sort of frozen in time because it has not been allowed to interact with anybody. And that's been an intentional effort by the Americans in order to placate China and make sure we get cheap stuff at Walmart while the Chinese Communist Party learns to behave like Canadians. It hasn't worked out. But that's the big problem, is that they never get the chance to train, or really associate the way they should with the Americans or anyone else, so that they've never improved their capabilities, and vice versa. If you're going to defend Taiwan, how can the Americans do it if they've never practiced with the Taiwan military beyond maybe a tabletop exercise? But it's had a demoralizing effect on the Taiwan military, to the point that recent years, some of the best officers have just got out. And it's demoralized the military, but also the way the populace sees its military. It doesn't really have the respect it used to have. It even comes to see, well, why should we bother trying to defend ourselves if we're not sure the Americans will help us? And this is, the Americans, of course, say, yeah, we've got you, don't worry, but we don't want to be seen in public with you. Why would anyone take us seriously at that point? And so that is I think, were the fundamental problems, that if that is not addressed, no statements of support, no visits by U.S. congressmen, etc., will sort of convince the Taiwanese that we're serious, or convince Beijing that we're serious about it either. The other thing that's necessary, in addition to treating Taiwan like an ally and training with them, is to, on the economic front, is to provide them with some preferential economic treatment, so that the average citizen, who really looks at economic matters more than military ones, sees that, well, yeah, the Americans really do care about us. The Americans are going to help us, and because they've done this, this, and this, my life is going to get better. So you have to combine the military with the economic front, and if you're going to really improve or sort of, I think, save Taiwan from sliding, sort of just giving up and sliding over to China. And that's not that complicated. And we'll see if this administration, it's done so many other things that nobody else has done, we'll see if it can actually address both of those things. I'm hoping they can. But what I proposed for a, you know, one way to deal with the joint training thing is you could immediately take the Taiwan Navy and some Seventh Fleet ships, take them out to Guam or sail around anywhere you want in the Pacific. The same thing, you can easily do it with the Air Force. That's what Anderson Air Force Base is out there on Guam for. Send them out to Guam and start operating together. Another alternative or possibility, which could easily be done if you turned it over to a couple captains and majors for an afternoon, is to set up what I would call a Central Pacific Humanitarian Assistance Disaster Relief Force based in Taiwan, with Taiwan military and Americans as well assigned to it, and they plan for, train, and exercise, and then respond for disasters which happen in the region. And the basis of it would be Taiwan and American amphibious forces. And if you have some success here, you could maybe get the Japanese or maybe the Australians or French or the British to join in. You've got to sort of create that interaction, which has not existed for 40 years. And if that's not done, I'm not optimistic about what's coming in the next 5 years.
Interesting. Okay, final question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about relative to this Pacific Rim or the subjects we've talked about that you want people to know about?
Well, what would that be? If you hang up the phone, then I'll think of
I call it the general question, but it's like the general article in a court martial. That's the general question interview. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you relative to events in the Pacific Rim? What about the economic consequences and the diplomatic consternation and awkwardness that comes with treating Taiwan like it is a independent nation?
Well, of course, Beijing will foul. You know, they could, Taiwan and even us, we could surrender tomorrow, and China would still complain about it. And that's going to happen. But the alternative to this is to effectively lose Taiwan to the free world. And once you've done that, if you look at the map, look at the geography, this is the equivalent, as I think I've said before, of the walls of Constantinople finally falling to the Mohammedans in 1453 and thus opening up South and Central Europe to invasion. This is something similar. Taiwan occupies key terrain on the so-called first island chain. If it's lost, suddenly the PLA, the Chinese, have access to the Western Pacific unfettered. They have outflanked Japan. They have potentially cut sort of a defense line going from Japan down to Australia. And the trade routes or the sea lines of communication and trade that go through the South China Sea in that area, China is in a position to sever them. Japan would go berserk, or Japan would not be very happy. And I think they'd have nuclear weapons in short order. I think they should probably have them today, in fact. But they certainly would if this happened. Nobody would believe any American promises about anything if this is allowed to happen. It's often not realized just what's at stake here. Should Taiwan not continue as effectively an independent nation and a free society with consensual government and individual liberties, all the things that Beijing says Chinese people cannot handle. So that's what really is worth understanding. It's easy not to quite get it if you don't live in the region and pay attention to the security or defense matters the way we do, where we tend to think everybody understands that. But I don't. But it needs to be explained, I think, better than it has been. So that's something that I think is always worth talking about. And the last thing that just came to mind is that, I've heard, friends of mine and, who are unhinged over Donald Trump, they all are harping about how America is pulling out of Asia. And, somehow Mr. Trump doesn't want to be here and we're leaving. And, thinking about this, I can't think of a single piece of evidence, anything which would suggest such is the case. And I pointed this out, and there's many other things which suggest that we are actually doing a lot more out here. And, it's the hatred of Mr. Trump is such that even sensible people kind of repeat these sorts of cliches, but there's got a lot more Marines down in Darwin. B-52s are flying out of Anderson over the South China Sea, etc. American ships are now going through the Taiwan Strait all the time. They're doing more in the South China Sea, like we talked about earlier. I can't think of a single place where U.S. forces have been pulled out or reduced. And this administration has shown a willingness no other administration has to take on China verbally and in concrete terms as well. So, but you hear this all the time particularly in D.C., with the commentariat and those people who are waiting for the restoration, and even the never Trumpers as well. But when you actually look for evidence, there's zero evidence on one side, and there's actually some nice examples you can trot out on the others. So that's what I would say.
All right. The whole policy of one China, especially when you look at the history of Taiwan and how it's never really been ruled as a part of China, even though there's been waves of Chinese immigrants that have gone out there. It's always been either ruled by another country, the Japanese, the French, the Dutch. So it's interesting. So the Chinese claim to it, obviously. But, again, the Chinese practice of economic extortion, if you want us to go along, you're going to have to go along with these policies. And one is there's only one China, and the Republic of China does not exist. So it's, again, it's another version of the Emperor's new clothes that they play.
Very much, but if nobody will explain it or say it, it tends to take on a life of its own. And
right.
This U.S. governments have never done a very good job of explaining it, and it's pretty simple. Taiwan has never been part of the People's Republic of China, period. And Formosa itself, the island of Taiwan, has only been under real Chinese control for about a decade in an empire, one of the dynasties a long, long time ago. And the dynasty wasn't even Chinese. And that's about as simple as it is. It'd be like us saying we have a claim to Vancouver Island. Well, not really. We could claim we had one, but we don't, and they don't.
Isn't that consistent with the way the Chinese manufacture their foreign policy and the way they, the way they evidently intend to get beyond the first island chain, and that is, the nine dash line is the same way.
That's it. You make it up.
Yeah. If it does, if the truth doesn't fit, we're going to make up our own narrative. We're going to sell it, and then we're going to blackmail everybody into saying, into nodding their head and playing the Emperor's New Clothes. And that's really what you see the Chinese do over and over again. So, well, you know, see, there you go. I've learned something all these visits. So there you have it.
That's because you're not talking to the State Department.
You're right.
No, I always tell people half jokingly that I always, no matter what I talk about, I always learn something unless I'm talking to the State Department. I'm not being mean, but it's kind of true, actually. So I'm glad you learned something.
There you go.
I do too. Well, so then.
Well, no, I mean, it is. I mean, it's honestly, it's like one of those things like, are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? My eyes? What? No. All right. Grant, first of all, thanks for giving up your time today, and joining us. Enjoy the day in Hawaii, and we will talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Okay. Bye-bye.
There you have it, Grant Newsham. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.